The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
It is Thursday, September 3rd, and the FBS schedule in college football begins tonight. I cannot wait. We are hours away, and ahead on this podcast, we got Nicole Auerbach, who gets us ready for the protocols that college football reporters and writers are going through, getting ready for a game, and also some of the stuff that's been put in for fans attending games this upcoming season, the challenges for coaches and players if we do not have fans inside stadiums dealing with the noise. Also, Andy Staples from The Athletic going to join us with his take on the SEC and the potential quarterback situation at Georgia, as well as how that's going to affect Florida and Alabama as they come back stronger than ever, especially on the defensive side, dealing with all the injuries last year. And also talk to Andy about briefly about if he had one place to eat and one final meal and it was barbecue, where would he go? Andy's an expert at that. And our man Rod Gilmore from ESPN joining us is also talking about his experience, you know, as a black man growing up here in America as an athlete, and what it's like right now for current athletes as they understand their voice, as well as his thoughts on how the Pac-12 handled their decision when it came to fall sports and pushing everything to 2021. Also want to remind you, something that's really dear to my heart, the Dickie V Gala. It's Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month, and Dickie V has been front and center, raising $30 million through the years for research in the battle against pediatric cancer. No parent should have to hear the words that their child has cancer. And Dickie V has a virtual gala. I'm lucky enough to host this gala in Sarasota in May. And of course, with COVID, it got pushed back. So we are going virtual this Friday night, and you could be a part of it to help raise money. Go to v.org/DickVitale. That's v.org/DickVitale. And again, the Dick Vitale team, Lorraine and Dick, they've raised nearly $30 million, and we are going to exceed that number. 7 p.m. Eastern Time on YouTube, September 4th, Friday night. The honorees are Gonzaga coach Mark Few, Stephen A. Smith, and Bucks head coach Bruce Arians. Also, the John Saunders V Foundation Courage Award. We have recipients Jim Kelly, NFL Hall of Famer, Pat Williams, former Orlando Magic executive, and Mitch Albom, best-selling author. I can't wait to be a part of it. I hope you guys can join us. Literally, all your dollars are going to cancer research for our fight against pediatric cancer. So, once again, it's September 4th, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on YouTube. Go to v.org/DickVitale. Here's the podcast. Hope you enjoy it, and I can't wait for football. It's great to have Nicole Auerbach joining us from The Athletic as we get ready for a season and anticipate some games coming our way. I think cautiously optimistic is the way to describe it, Nicole. And you have something out talking about the first FBS games kicking off tonight, and then we've got more coming up on Saturday. The planning here, what's been going on? Because, again, so such unique times, so many different questions, and each venue is different. Each state is different with the policies and what's required. What's been going on behind the scenes in the last couple of months leading up to this when it comes to no tailgating and you got to go mobile everything?
Yeah, it's a great point that this is different depending on where you are. So not only have these administrators been trying to figure out, you know, like what can work on our own campus, our stadium, our fans, but also like you're waiting to get that, okay, what is the capacity going to be able to be like go ahead from the state? And so you've had a number of people, like they've had all of these different models of like, okay, 10% capacity, 20, 25, 50. And then you have places that are going to be like North Carolina is opening the season with no fans, right? So you have like, you can have all these contingency plans, which take a ton of effort to figure out how you're going to model out the seating clusters, right? And then it could just totally be irrelevant and wiped away. So people have been working on these for 6 months. You know, obviously hopeful that there would be a season, but understanding that it could look totally different than it has before. So I think some of the more interesting things that, you know, you'll experience if you are lucky enough to go to a game, if your team is playing and they're able to have fans. But I think some of these things we'll also see on TV. You know, I talked to administrators for the two games tonight from UAB and Southern Miss, and then Miami and Texas put out really, really detailed protocol. So I talked to them as well. And so, yes, it absolutely starts with a lot of places are flat out banning tailgating. I think that people will probably be allowed to, like, if you and I went to a game together, we rode in the same car, we wanted to sit behind the car, you know, have a beer, like no one's going to come over and police us. But they're trying to discourage larger groups, groups of people that aren't kind of already in each other's, you know, bubble or whatever we want to refer to it as, for people that you're already in close contact with. And then, you know, they've been spending all this time and energy on like figuring out, you know, are you going to be assigned a specific gate to go in, a specific time that you can enter? So just to try to stagger arrivals and again, like not have giant crowds. And then there's a number of things inside, like, yes, mobile ticketing, but maybe mobile concessions ordering. And maybe the concession food is prepackaged so that, you know, again, it's less surfaces that people are touching, that other people are touching. Miami is actually doing my two favorite details about this whole thing. Miami is doing contactless toilets. They replaced anything related to their toilets so that you don't have to, like, literally put your hand in to flush it. And then also they upgraded their air conditioning vents for their indoor spaces in a suite. Which is very cool and very interesting because, you know, you think outdoor sports, but obviously there's indoor spaces and this is a respiratory pandemic. So that's really important too. So there's just so much attention to detail. And I think like from a TV watching standpoint, we'll notice it when we'll look, you know, we'll have a crowd shot and you'll see like a group of four people together, then 6 feet and another group of people, you know, we'll see like the spaced out clusters. We'll see the masks on the sidelines. You know, North Carolina will hear piped in, you know, crowd noise because they won't have real fans. But, you know, I think a lot of these experiences will be rather unique for people who actually go to the games in person.
Yeah. How about now this experience? We've seen it now in the in Major League Baseball where you're playing in your own open air stadium and you have the cutouts. And, you know, if you know, you're a Phillies fan, you can hear actually fans outside the gate with their air horns. And that's the only type of interaction that's going on the field. Have you talked to players and coaches about this approach with Matt Brown talking about piped in noise and Dan Mullen talking about, hey, you know, earlier in the week, have we figured out as a conference how much piped in noise are we going to have? What's been their approach to this challenge?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I know the ACC has approved it because there's a couple schools there. And now we know Iowa State is a new school that's going to open without fans. So I guess everyone will have to figure that out. And I'm sure that there are like lists and rules and things regarding that. But I think it'll be better than nothing. I think like, you know, from a standpoint of, you know, consuming the sports that have come back already, I think, you know, when there's been a big shot in the NBA and there was, you know, whoever was in charge of doing the crowd noise, like nailed it. Like that makes you feel like it was a normal big moment. And then like, you know, with some of the golf without anything, it's like, oh, like, I kind of wish you'd hear that swell of the crowd. So I still think it's better than nothing. I'm sure that people whose job it is to figure out how that stuff works will do it. Because I think, you know, it's going to be weird for the players and the coaches to not have the energy of the crowd. But I think, you know, anything that is better than just like dead silence, like a scrimmage is probably better. Like Mac Brown was saying, like they did pipe in noise and music and things for their scrimmage to test it out. And also like, cause the sidelines are going to feel different. Like they're going to be more spread out and socially distanced and the coaches have masks on. So it might be harder to hear people because you might be a little bit more further apart. So like people have to work through that too. So I just think it's going to be really interesting. Like there's just all these little wrinkles that, you know, are so minor, but like people are going to have to like pay attention to and kind of, you know, adjust to. That I think it's going to be really cool to see people adapt and to do those things.
You know who's jealous of this conversation that we're having? Fans of the Pac-12 and fans of the Big Ten.
Yeah.
Because this hypothetical and the Big Ten story won't go away. It's now turned into a political conversation with the president of the United States calling the commissioner, Kevin Warren, and now The reaction from the Big Ten, the rumors that are being put out there on potentially dates as early as after Thanksgiving. I've heard after Christmas. I've heard one scenario, October 3rd, October 10th. What are you hearing from your sources on where this is at right now while we're taping this Thursday at 1:24 Eastern time with the very latest on a potential return or moving up the schedule and playing football later this fall?
Yeah, I mean, I understand why everyone's been so excited and hopeful that things could speed up the process. But, the October dates that have been rumored, I believe are coming from coaches who obviously want to play as soon as possible. But these teams are not in training camp right now. There's no way they can play October 3rd. They can play games. But also I think that is just, wishful thinking that, okay, if we start those days, we can get in a full season by the time the college football playoff is picking its team, so Ohio State can get in and get its shot at the national championship. That's where those days are coming from. But really what's actually happening hasn't changed in the last week, even with the phone call from the president and potential, I do think there could be help. There could be help with rapid tests and other resources, contact tracing. And again, all of the reasons, the medical reasons that the Big Ten isn't playing, there can be advances and help with. But my sources who are on these committees that are figuring this out, the return to play task force, they are saying that the next step for the Big Ten is to figure out its medical benchmark. So that could be, community transmission rates. That could be contact tracing. It could be a number of tests available, turnaround times on tests and all their campuses, or if you have more access to rapid testing and they're accurate, just like all these little pieces that would need to kind of be outlined before they can figure out a restart date. Because basically they want to say okay, these were the reasons we shut it down. So these are the criteria that need to be met for us to restart. So that's still the next point in this process. As of today at this time, because you're right, we do need to timestamp these things because they change very quickly.
Yeah.
The models being looked at, the earliest one that is actually in the subcommittees being looked at is that one, the end of November after Thanksgiving. But still, it feels more likely. And the after Christmas timeframe is what I've been hearing as well, is January. And I think that, the coaches have wanted as early as possible so that it would impact next fall as little as possible. And I think starting in January does that because, they just want to make sure that you don't have to delay the start of the 2021 fall season and things like that. So to me, that's still where we're at. They're looking at figuring out those medical thresholds, seeing what resources can change if they can get more, medical equipment for testing related to cardiac issues and things like that. But I mean, the reasons that they shut it down for the fall are still very much there. I mean, none of that has changed in 3 weeks, despite people being angry.
Yeah, and the more information also when it comes to myocarditis and how it's affecting players and hopefully there's more transparency when another decision is announced, if there is going to be another decision. How about this concept of, okay, if you start the season, and I get the idea that to me it's completely unrealistic to think that football will be played in March and April because it just doesn't make sense. You are now compromising the fall of 2021. If
right.
you have this idea of playing at the end of December, then how about this concept of the Big Ten and the Pac-12 coming together and saying, hey, let's figure this out together. Let's do it together and then have a potential Rose Bowl at the end.
I would love to see that.
Have you heard anything about the Pac-12 working with the Big Ten on something like this? Or has it just been off the table in the Pac-12? We are not going to entertain anything the rest of this calendar year.
Well, I think, I am sure that those two leagues, which, by the way, they made their decisions to go conference-only scheduling, and to postpone the fall, within 24 hours of each other both
yes.
times, right? So these leagues are clearly on a similar time frame or prioritization, and their medical experts are seeing the data in similar ways. So I expect that they would try to coordinate their time frame. Maybe it doesn't have to be the exact same start date. But I think that, you know, if you talk to coaches in the league, like, they would love the idea of getting to end the season in a Rose Bowl. Because, I mean, think about the holdup to getting a playoff for so long was the Big Ten and the Pac-12's relationship with the Rose Bowl. Like, it was more important than a national championship, a true playoff, to play in that stadium. So I would love to see that. I don't think anything is off the table at this point. But I do think that, you know, the Pac-12 right out of the gate was more cautious than the Big Ten, you know, postponing, you know, all events, including non-conference basketball. It sounds like they're potentially going to reconsider that depending on the start date of basketball season. So I do think there's some flexibility. Again, it's more about, you know, the environment that these schools were in, their regions, their communities, you know, 3 weeks ago when these decisions were made and projecting into the semester. And I do think that there is going to be time to figure out if you can align in such a way where your two champions get to play in the Rose Bowl. But to me, that seems like a very possible, if not even likely, outcome to give both leagues something to play for, because that's been one of the issues, right? If you're playing in the spring, mm-hmm. it's basically a glorified exhibition. But if you get to end the season in the Rose Bowl, I mean, that's something that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it would be really cool. It'd be cool for, I think, the fan bases that have been patient, as well as the players and the programs, because nothing can touch the environment of the Rose Bowl. And if you could play in Pasadena to close out your season and a season that we've never seen before, that would be something positive. And we're trying to stay on the positive here on this podcast. Nicole, you've been great. I wish you the best of health and safety moving on, covering these games on the road or whether you're at home. It's a huge challenge, but thanks for joining us here on the College Football Podcast.
Absolutely. Anytime, and stay safe too.
As we continue the College Football Podcast, I'm just so happy he can join us. Andy Staples joining us from The Athletic. And there's so much I want to talk to you about, buddy. You know, you came from Sports Illustrated, went to The Athletic, and it's going to be a different lifestyle for you this upcoming season. I think for anybody that's surrounded by college football when it comes to travel. But with that, where are you right now? What are you getting prepared to do?
I am in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, preparing to go to see a football game, which if you'd asked me if I thought I would be doing that 2 months ago, I'd have said, I don't think so. So it's been quite a, ride here. It's just, it's so strange because every day is just story after story that would be the biggest story in the sport for an entire week, except it lasts maybe 30 minutes. It's just been crazy. And then, you know, I find myself sitting there watching Central Arkansas Austin Peay on TV on Saturday night, like, they're actually doing this. This yep. is happening. Yep. There's a football game. This is going on. And it's funny because that's how I felt for about the first half. And then the second half, I just got the flow of the game. And I'm like, all right, they're using their quarterback to punt.
Well, make sure the room is protected with the long snappers, right? Like there was a lot of things going on. And I think we're going to be saying that repeatedly each and every single game. There's a lot of things going on. We don't know what's going on, but thank goodness we're watching football. You're getting ready. What, Southern Miss, South Alabama? What are the protocols? What can you tell us that you've had to be prepared for? You know, with this, I imagine being your first game, what do you anticipate your schedule will be like when things start to open up in the next couple of weeks?
Well, it's interesting because they haven't really told us much about how it's going to work. And other than you got to have a mask and you're going to be at least, you know, 6 feet apart from everybody in the press box. I've seen some protocols for some other press boxes popping up where I know like Florida State is limiting it to 40 people in the press box, which is a big press box, but holds way more than 40 people. So, you got that. Certain schools are doing it where, you know, you're not going to be able to go down and talk to the coaches and players. That'll be on Zoom. And, you know, it's one of the things where you just have to roll with the punches. And, you know, I was going around Southern Miss's campus this morning and just looking around and, it's pretty quiet. You know, there are students on campus, but you don't see a ton of them just walking around. Everybody you see walking around has a mask on. It's just a different world now. And it was interesting. The first thing I noticed was when I rolled onto the campus at 9 in the morning, there were parking spots available. Like There are never parking spots available on a college campus at 9 in the morning. Yes. So that tells you it's a different world.
You know, as we get ready for the season to start, or the season is underway, but I'm saying the meat of things, I gave the SEC a ton of credit for waiting till September 26th and being patient. Now, as we see, you know, it feels like the Big 12 and, you know, the American and Conference USA, all these conferences can get the chance, and the ACC get the chance to kind of fill in the gap here before the SEC schedule. Now, a piece of me is like, man, I wish the ACC started now so we can build in some weeks off if we have to have an outbreak and we need a break, right? Like, what's your thought process on how the SEC's handled this? What are you hearing about moving forward as now we're still over 3 weeks away from watching that conference play?
Well, the SEC's idea the entire time, I mean, you could go back to March if you want to hear Greg Sankey say this, and he hasn't changed his tone one bit, is give yourself as much time as humanly possible to make these decisions. And that's what they've done. And I think it probably gives them some comfort as they get going here, because they can watch other college football leagues play. They can watch the NFL play, and then they can adjust what they do based on what they see. Or if they wanted to, entirely pull the plug if things aren't working. But it looks, just based on what we've seen preliminarily, that it is going to work, that everybody's going to be able to play. So this allows them to just sort of tweak things. But yeah, it is interesting, because like the NC State Virginia Tech example, you know, NC State had to pause. They were scheduled to play Virginia Tech on September 12th. They both had an open date on September 26th, so they just moved the game. So,
yes.
Yeah, I do wonder which is the wiser move, because that's all this is everybody's just guessing. You know, mm-hmm. The Big Ten and the Pac-12 were just guessing when they postponed. The SEC was just guessing when they decided to wait and schedule for their date. The ACC was just guessing when they decided their date, because people don't know enough about this virus and won't. It's new. Everybody's flying blind here. My issue with the Big Ten and the Pac-12 was you didn't have to make that decision on August 11th.
Yep.
You could have made that decision on September 10th. Why did you have to wait that? Or why did you have to do that? I mean, I know the Big Ten had games scheduled on September 5th, but they could have just moved them. They had spent, you know, previous, you know, 6 days earlier, they had introduced their schedule, and they had bragged on how many different ways they could alter the schedule and still get the games in. So why didn't they do that?
Yeah,
and just wait and see what happens.
The argument we've heard, at least be leaked out, is, you know, the contact-to-contact drills when you put on the pads for practice. I'm with you on that. I'm with you on the concept of, hey, can you just wait it out? Like, you can cancel the season, or at least the fall season, but can we just be a little more patient in waiting this out? Especially 6 days after you release the schedule and you're coming off what you, what the MAC did that Saturday, I think shocked many people, because that Friday night felt really good, right? It felt like there was a schedule release, the SEC, and it looks like we're trending towards something really good. And then Friday night you go to bed, and Saturday morning you wake up and you're like, whoa, what's going on? How did we get here all of a sudden? Now there's another layer here, and I wanted to get your thoughts with the SEC, you know, having, at least as of right now, moving forward with this idea of having a season, but then you start to lose some stars, headlined by Ja'Marr Chase at LSU, and then Jamie Newman, that story coming out yesterday with Georgia. What was your first reaction when you heard about Ja'Marr Chase and then the recent news with Jamie Newman?
For Ja'Marr Chase, I was surprised it took that long.
I agree.
Ja'Marr Chase didn't have anything to prove in college football. I mean, I think in a normal year, Ja'Marr Chase would have played and it would have been fine. And that it would have been no big deal. But with all this other stuff going on with COVID and with you not knowing if it's going to affect your health long term, and Ja'Marr Chase did not need to play this season. So I had no issue with him opting out. Now, Tyler Shelvin probably could have made himself some money, and mm-hmm. he opted out as well. The Jamie Newman thing, he definitely could have made himself some money playing for Georgia this season. I don't know exactly what the reasons were on the opt-out. I've heard, you know, several different things. But it's not to help his draft stock. That's for sure. From a financial standpoint, that decision likely will cost him some money. So, I mean, everybody has to make the right decision for them. But I think the thing with the opt-outs that I'm going to be interested to see is how many guys have three or four good games and then suddenly decide to opt out.
Because that's an excellent point.
Enough on tape. So that's another thing. So if you think just because your stars are still on your team that you're good and that means you're going to dominate these teams that had a bunch of opt-outs, don't be so certain about that. Because mid-season, you may lose some of those guys. And honestly, the teams with the best freshman and sophomore talent are going to be the ones, I think, that at the end of the year, the ones that are winning.
Yeah, that's something to keep an eye on. Do you think the idea, you know, with JT Daniels sliding in, do you think the idea of losing Jamie Newman, does that change anything in the East? Because for me personally, I know your background. You know my wife's background. Florida Gators, regardless. I don't think you ever weigh that into any conversation, any decision making. But I in my house, it's Gators, Gators, Gators. And I told my wife specifically, I said, the one bonus that your team has is consistency at quarterback with Kyle Trask, knowing what Dan Mullen's offense will do. And I bring that up that any transition, you don't have a spring game, you don't have a normal summer practice. I think experience will be critical coming in to this season where you know the offense, you don't hesitate, you move forward.
Well, and Trask is in the situation. I wrote about this a week ago and made a list of all the quarterbacks who are playing in the same offense that they started in last year with the same coaching staff. And it's not many. And so, yeah, Kyle Trask is at a big advantage there. Florida's at a big advantage. And remember, Emory Jones has played quite a bit for Florida.
Yes,
so
yeah.
Even if, let's say Kyle Trask got hurt, Emory Jones could come in and run that offense just fine. So they're in very good shape as far as that goes. With Georgia, I don't know what happened to that because I don't know how good Jamie Newman was. I thought he could be pretty good in that offense. I liked watching him at Wake Forest. I thought, you know, with Todd Monken coming in, he's done a lot of different things offensively. You know, you saw him with Brandon Weeden at Oklahoma State. You saw him with Nick Mullins at Southern Miss. He was in the NFL. So you think he's going to come in and modernize that offense a little bit. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I don't know if it's going to be JT Daniels. It could be DeJuan Mathis. That's the other thing. Is DeJuan Mathis was a guy who went through spring practice for Georgia last year. They found a cyst on his brain. He had to have emergency surgery, and he was out for all last season. So everybody just kind of forgot about him. But he's a 6'6 guy. He was kind of a string bean when he got to campus, but now he's filled out a little bit. So he and JT Daniels, I guess, will be the ones who duke it out for that job.
It helps that you have George Pickens there too. When you look around.
Exactly. And Zamir White. I mean, turn around and hand it to Zamir White, throw it to George Pickens. That's the thing. Georgia has so much talent. And I realize they are replacing a lot on the offensive line, but they also have recruited very well on the offensive line. So I think whoever wins the job, you will have a sense of ease because you have so much talent around you. And look, Kyle Trask enjoying the same thing at Florida. Now, there was the moment where you thought, okay, Trevon Grimes and Jacob Copeland may not be playing. That could be problematic. But now they've said they're going to play. So that's something to watch, too. That was – I called that more of a holdout than an opt-out. But the fact that it happened gives you pause and makes you wonder, okay, is Florida going to have its full complement of receivers
game
day?
You describe it as a holdout, considering the opt-out. Now, we haven't even talked about Alabama. And obviously, there's a lot of things that can change, but you can't ignore that backfield and the talent with Waddle and Harris. Like, I come back to a team where Mac Jones knows this offense. Don't sleep on the freshman recruit that they brought in. And I don't know. Like, Bryce Young is one of those guys that I could see him playing, you know, 3 weeks into the season. And I could be completely wrong, but I could see it because just he's that talented. How do you look at Alabama, especially how dominant that offensive line is when they come back?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Alex Leatherwood coming back, and again, it goes back to what we talked to, guys who came back with the idea that they're going to make themselves some more money. And I think Alex Leatherwood is in that boat. I think Devontae Smith is in that boat at Alabama. If you look at the numbers, Devontae Smith was just about as good as Ja'Marr Chase last year. I mean, he's right up there with best receiver in America category. So I'm really interested to see what this offense looks like, because I think the quarterback, it's just icing on the cake if you get a really dynamic quarterback running that offense.
Yes.
You don't need it.
Yes.
If you have it. And the thing is, we don't know how good Mac Jones could be. He showed some flashes last year. So either one of those guys, if they turn out to be special, I don't know how you stop that group.
I'm not sure.
The other thing about Alabama that people need to consider is that defense last year, when Dylan Moses went down, they were very thin at inside linebacker. They're playing guys that probably they never expected they'd have to play that early. They already knew they were going to be young up front, and they were young up front. It showed, but they're going to be better up front and in the linebacker group this year, because Moses is back. The other guys have some experience. They know what they're doing now. That defense is going to be really good. I don't know if it's going to be as good as Georgia's, but it's going to be up there. And so you have what looks like a very complete Alabama team. What we had grown accustomed to seeing, and it was a little weird last year seeing them kind of depleted on defense. It's not going to be the case this year. They're not depleted anyway.
Not depleted. We talked a little bit about the SEC. I want to get your thoughts quickly about the talk, and what do you hear? What's out there? Mike Tannenbaum, who's a front office insider at ESPN, he threw out an interesting scenario when the Jaguars released Leonard Fournette, and this concept of tanking for Trevor Lawrence, but a potential package deal down the road in Jacksonville where Trevor Lawrence and Dabo Sweeney could come together. What are you hearing in college football circles about that? Because that was the first time I've heard anything with Dabo in the NFL. Usually it's Dabo in Alabama, and does he want to still stay at Clemson? And those rumors, it seemed to be squashed last year. But I've never made a connection of Dabo to the NFL. And when Tannenbaum brought it up, I was like, oh, that's intriguing. What are you hearing in college football circles about this?
It's not something that's been talked about a whole lot. And he's never struck me as a guy who'd want to coach in the NFL. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like Dabo could coach just about anywhere as long as he brought the right assistants along with him. And he's more of a CEO organ. Remember, he's not a play caller. Mm-hmm. And so he's handling all that other stuff. The thing with Dabo is, I couldn't see him going to the NFL without personnel control. You have to give him full control of the personnel, because that's what he's used to. And I just don't know. I get the sense from him that the Clemson is where he wants to retire, that, he is, instead of going back to Alabama and trying to be the next Nick Saban or the next Bear Bryant, he's the first Dabo Sweeney at Clemson.
Yep.
And he can just be that. And, if he wants to just go, and the thing is, it's interesting because he's a younger guy, but if he wanted to Bob Stoops it, he'd be out in like 5 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and enjoy a lot of things, already be a legend wherever you go. I mean, he's a legend in the parts of where he lives in that region, but across the board, Mike T, and to be fair to Tannenbaum's story, he painted it that he would be more like a Pete Carroll, where you bring the energy. We saw the transition Carroll, but let's not forget Carroll was an NFL coach before he went to USC and revived his career. But then he came back to Seattle. So he came back to the NFL. So he likened the idea of it's a home run in that area, in that Duval County, Jacksonville area, because Clemson is not that far away and the whole place would embrace the concept of Trevor Lawrence and Dabo coming as a package deal. It was, whether there's anything to it, it was just one of those, if you talk out loud, this could potentially work, considering the factory that Clemson's turning into producing talent the same way USC was, in the early part of this century.
Yeah. I'm curious if his style would work in the NFL. I remember when I covered Urban Meyer as a beat writer and he was at Florida, he he would always say that he didn't think what he did would work in the NFL. I tended to agree with him. It was a little too rah-rah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually a great point.
The NFL players just might not be down for that. And Dabo, I don't think is quite that extreme on that end, but I don't know that he would connect as well with NFL players as he does with the college guys. So, and he's pretty self-aware when it comes to that too. So I'd be curious, you know, it's one of those things that now that it's out there, he's probably never going to actually talk about it in a very straightforward manner. But because I mean, listen, let's be honest. If somebody said, you know, about me, hey, you know, Andy could be going somewhere else as a package deal, I'm probably going to let that linger out there for a little while, just in case, you know, next contract time, the Athletics like, ooh, we don't want to lose you. Here's some more.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. You're doing the job of the agent. The agent just says, all right, I don't need to do anything else. We're good to go. The rumor's already out there. We don't need to address it. Let's just let it float around. We need to address this before we let you go, Andy. Food. That is college football and food are hand in hand at every tailgate. And you have mastered this art of places to go and what to eat. How will that change when it comes to your schedule this upcoming season?
It just depends on how much I'm going to be on the road. We don't know that yet. I have a list at The Athletic of 300 places that I've been that I absolutely loved, and it's going to be a living document. I'm going to keep adding to it as I go to new places. Now, unfortunately, it's a living document in that when a place closes, we have to take it off. So we're going to be doing some adjustments this week. I've got to take two off that unfortunately didn't make it through COVID. And I got two more to add, one that I had yesterday. So if you are in Mobile, Alabama, there's a barbecue place called Meat Boss. It is one of the best pulled pork sandwiches you will ever have in your life. Get it on the sweet roll. Order the sauce on the side. It doesn't need it. One thing you can get, though, and it's interesting because most barbecue places don't say, well, you can put all this different stuff on your pulled pork sandwich. They've got quite a few options. One of the options is jalapeno jelly.
Oh.
Get the jalapeno jelly.
Oh, man. We're recording this at lunchtime. It's just not fair. I mean, you have mastered this. Is there a favorite food, the best barbecue you've ever had that you could share with us?
It depends on the meat. Like my favorite ribs are at Archibald's in Northport, Alabama. My favorite brisket is Franklin in Austin.
Let's narrow this down. You have one last meal, and it's your choice of barbecue. Where are you going?
Rack Archibald's ribs would be good if I got to go. That's a good way to go out.
Gosh, I'm so jealous. Andy, you're the best. I appreciate you joining us here on the College Football Podcast. And have fun in Hattiesburg and stay safe the rest of this upcoming season.
Thanks, Kevin.
And it's great to have one of my favorite people at ESPN, Rod Gilmore, joining us here on the College Football Podcast. Been at ESPN, for 24 years? ABC and ESPN joining the network in 1996. And Rod, you've seen a lot of things. There's a lot of things we could talk about here. So much to cover. How would you describe the summer and where we're at now as we approach the fall and with football in certain parts of the country beginning? How would you describe what has been going on? And I know this is a very broad general question, but it'll help me understand what's off the top of your mind that has stood out in the last 5 months.
Well, first of all, it's great to catch up with you. It's been a while since I haven't been back to Bristol in a minute, so we haven't been, you know, able to chat too much, but it's great to catch up with you. It's just amazing the kind of year that this has been, unpredictable. I mean, I don't know who would have figured all the things that have come together this year to create just probably, in my view, the worst year I can imagine. A pandemic, and out here in California, we've had fires and the sports world has turned upside down. It's all pretty surreal. For me, I just can't wrap my head around the notion that we are trying to get our arms around a pandemic and the social justice systemic discrimination that's been going on for a long time, that it all came together, a confluence of these things at one time, and has turned the world upside down. How we come out of this, how we deal with it, you know, as a society, and how we deal with it in the sports world, is, I think, remaking the way we feel about sports, the way we look at sports. And in my area, in college football, I think college football is going to be changed forever, if for no other reason, the rise of player empowerment caused by what we've seen this year in the pandemic, and the social justice area. Players will not go back to being the guys who were simply following orders of coaches and administrators. They are far too empowered now, and I think that will change college football forever.
What kind of role do you think, the voice of the athlete, especially in the college football side of things, building up in June and July, and the idea of we want more transparency coming from the Pac-12 and the group of players, the coalition, as well as the Big Ten. What kind of role do you think that played in the decision-making process of the Pac-12 saying we won't have fall sports, as well as the Big Ten, which is right now, as the time of us taping this is 12:26 on a Thursday, as of right now, no fall football and spring football. That's subject to change if that spring football is moved up. But what kind of role do you think it played in the conference's decision-making process?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm curious as to what you think. I'll tell you where I am, how I see this. I think the Pac-12 Big Ten decision was just extraordinary, because normally those of us who have been critical of college athletics believe that money drives everything. You can't really say that in this instance with that decision, because of the extraordinary cost that both conferences had endured. I mean, if you just look across the board, I mean, Michigan and Wisconsin are both talking about $100 million loss from their budgets. The Pac-12 cut their Pac-12 network. 88 employees lost their jobs. There have been salary cuts. So they've just taken the pain, the financial pain, right now that other conferences may see later, but they took it right now. And that's just not the sort of thing that you expect, that financial matters would drive the decision, but it clearly did not here. I do believe player safety was the overwhelming factor. However, I can't believe for a second that the fact that players were trying to organize and create an association, because they can't really create a union, that wasn't a factor. That was a problem for the Pac-12 and for the Big Ten. I have heard for years from administrators and coaches that the worst fear was players organizing and pushing back and trying to get a seat at the table. So I believe that was a factor. How much of a factor, I'm not certain, but I know it was something that concerned administrators and coaches in both conferences. What's your reaction to it?
My reaction is that twofold. The idea that the Pac-12 can be unified and make sure that they were transparent from the start and how they communicated with the 12-page letter that they produced, backing it up with the medical information to answer many of the questions, how the ADs and the coaches have not been seeking a microphone and voicing an opinion. Just, hey, this is how we voted. This is how we're going. We're moving forward together as a conference on the same page. And then you have the Nebraska speaking out, Ohio State, Penn State AD, how that all played out. My biggest issue is that Kevin Warren was used as a scapegoat. Now, Kevin and his communications team in the Big Ten failed him, as well as he failed in the interview process afterwards on addressing why they did it, instead of just saying, oh, this is just our decision and medical concerns. They should have been much more transparent. I've said this repeatedly on the podcast. I get ticked off that, granted, the commissioner's there to take it, just like we see in the NFL. Roger Goodell does the bidding of the owners, and the owners don't want to face the media. That's what we're seeing with Kevin Warren, and the presidents and the chancellors did. The vote is out there, 11-3, but publicly not one of them speaking out in support of Kevin Warren's decision, and Kevin has to answer to everything. I thought that was a failure across the board. Now, I come back to one word, and I've said this repeatedly. While player safety is a concern, Liability to me is the biggest thing. With the unknown of a novel virus, nobody wants to be liable of the ramifications down the road with the unknown and the heart issues and some of the data that's coming in. The most disappointing thing about this whole thing in the pandemic is that at one point, months ago, it felt like the Power Five was lockstep together. And this is the charm, I guess, in college football. It's a segmented country, segmented in many ways. And it felt like in August, it was, I'm not sure what you're doing. I know what I'm doing, but I'm not telling you what I'm going to do. But we're going to just do it. And no one communicating with anybody when it comes to that stuff. Or communicating, but maybe not being transparent in the process. So when the decisions came out, this was this jumbled jigsaw that we're trying to piece together into a season. And I think that that's unfair to the sport. I think that's unfair when you don't have one singular voice. And it's also unfair when you don't have one medical advisory board and you don't have singular third-party testing. So when you have this stuff broken up, you have, hey, who's playing this week? I don't know. Who's starting this week? Let's see the schedule, right? It's not unified when I think now more than ever in a pandemic, as well as not just, you know, with the virus, but the racial strife in this country, two pandemics, that we don't have more unity in this decision-making process.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts about that. One is, you know, we're a country that takes a lot of pride in American individualism. And we've seen that in the pandemic. People are more concerned about their individual rights than the collective good. And that's also the case with college football. Each conference is focused on what's good for them, their individual goals and rights, and not so much what is great for the sport. And we're just not in the short run going to get any of these conferences to give up that power, the control that they have within their conference to a single voice, a single commissioner. That may be something that never changes and will continue to be a problem. The other thing that has distressed me all these months is the fact that, you know, we're talking about amateur players. The NCAA has really pushed that for the last several years, how important amateurism is. They've pushed it in courts and the legal cases. They pushed it before the state legislatures. And now they're treating players like essential employees, that, you know, football is so essential to what we need as a country that they're, in a sense, forced to be a part of it. Now, you've got to opt out, but, you know, that's really kind of a difficult thing. Anyway, I think we're seeing the beginning of the end of amateurism because it just doesn't work and players are responding to it. We're looking at not just the lawsuits and the state legislatures with name, image, and likeness. We're also looking at senators talking about bringing their own legislation to allow players to share in revenues and the like. So this whole thing is going to change. And I think a lot of people have had a problem with the fact that we have amateurs on the front line, so to speak, trying to help save the financial impact on the college athletic industry.
Your background, of course, Stanford. I didn't even know that you went to Cal as well. Is that where you got a master's?
Law school. Cal for law school.
So,
the question is where my loyalties lie.
Yes. Well, I would think Stanford first.
I like to tell people that really your undergrad is where you enjoy yourself. You hate professional school or master's because they just work you like a dog. So why would you be, you know, have some preference for your grad school as opposed to your undergrad?
And all your sweat went, of course, with Stanford and the football team. And with that in mind, your ties to the Pac-12 are relevant for this question because, again, we laugh and chuckle about the Big Ten, but honestly, who knows what's going to happen if there's a potentially moving up the season. But how realistic is it for the Pac-12 to discuss moving forward on a spring football season? And the concept of player safety being the most important thing here, and then the idea of playing two seasons in a 12-month calendar. How realistic is that concept of moving forward having a Pac-12 spring football season?
Well, let me be blunt. I think it's a horrible idea. I think it's a terrible idea to consider a spring season. That doesn't mean that they won't try and push it through and get it done. But from a player safety standpoint, it makes no sense to me. We've had the NCAA and the conferences and the coaches for a number of years push player safety. And the thought of trying to play two seasons in a 9 or 10 month period, it makes no sense at all. The recovery time just isn't there. You're exposing players to the risk of injury, maybe not as much in the spring, but that following season in the fall with very little time to recover and to rebuild your body. A lot of players would be at risk. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're already pushing players through a fall. Think about what's happened with these players. They came back early in the summer for a special 6-week training camp to get ready for their regular training camp. And then they're continuing sort of a spring season this fall. And then you'll turn around and you know, rev it up for them for a spring season. And they'll get a month or two off before you go into your summer training. It's way too much football. It doesn't work for them. Not to mention, no one is paying any attention to the academic toll that it takes on these players to be that consumed with football for that long. Having been a college football player and student, I can tell you, it is no fun to try to study and concentrate when you're constantly beat up in pain. It's a difficult thing. You need breaks so that you can refresh and you can be mentally focused on what you're trying to do in the classroom.
I'm really glad you brought up the aspect of being mentally focused, because there's a lot, and we briefly discussed this. There's a lot going on when it comes to being a college student, whether you're on campus or online learning, considering if you're a person of color. And we have seen that what the NBA has done, we've seen what the NFL has done and the WNBA, and you know, we've seen the NHL respond and Major League Baseball and a variety of MLS. We've seen a variety of different leagues protest in their form of protest. And, you know, the NFL in the last week, a week and a half, you know, off of, you know, the horrific tragedy and shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the aftermath afterwards, teams not practicing. We've seen college football teams not practicing. We've seen marches as well through campus. Nick Saban leading one earlier this week. If something, and I posed this question last week, if something were to happen, God forbid, again during the season, what do you anticipate? Because we live in a world where reality, no matter what, you're holding your breath on when's the next time something like this is going to happen.
Right.
What do you anticipate is going to happen on the college level with these athletes, where they're coming off a summer of understanding the power of their voice? Could you foresee us watching football players saying, I don't want to play this Saturday, I'm not playing?
Oh, absolutely. We're at a very, very fragile point. And I think one of the things that really gets overlooked when we talk about the college football season is really the impact of the social justice, systemic racism issue on players, and particularly Black players. You know, we focus on the pandemic, but we tend to forget that these players are really the target demographic of a lot of police brutality. You know, I've had my own experiences in my lifetime with police brutality and police harassment. And most of it occurred, you know, when I was under 30. And, you know, I have a son and I worry about him because he's under 30. And every Black man I know has had some form of police brutality or harassment. And these players are in that demographic. They know every time they get into a car, every time they're somewhere out in public, there is a risk to them. And a lot of them have talked about that. And that weighs on them. That's a heavy, heavy burden while you're trying to be a good teammate, be a great student, be a part of the campus and what's going on. And you know that you are this close to being the next guy who could be on a videotape. And we've heard a number of players talk about their fears and their concerns. And you probably saw that LSU players, last Saturday, at the last minute, decided to boycott practice. Instead, they protested and walked across campus. And Coach Orgeron had no idea it was going to happen. These players are under a lot of stress, and it's not talked about enough. Hopefully they get enough support and they have the outlets in which to address these things. But people just don't understand the amount of stress and pressure these players and theater that they have right now in this environment. If we have another incident, I doubt that we'll have much of a college football season. At least we'll lose a weekend or two, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Rod, it's up to you, too, if I'm treading lightly here. Well, could you share your experience? What was your experience like? You mentioned it at a young age. What did you go through?
Oh, there's so many. I can't give you the exact number, but yeah. It started at an early age. I mean, I had three older brothers who were harassed at times and the like. And my father told me when I was probably 10 or 11, listen, this is what you do when you are stopped by the police, because it will happen. And, you know, I lived in a predominantly black neighborhood and I was bused to a predominantly white school. And I remember, you know, going to visit my friends as a teenager, you know, 14, 15 years old, being stopped by the police and asked why I was in that neighborhood. And I would tell them I'm visiting friends, and they would tell me I did not belong there. I didn't live there, you know, and they followed me, and we didn't have cell phones or anything. And I was a little bit, nervous to say the least.
Yeah.
I've had incidents where I've been, you know, stopped by the police. The most recent one, a couple of years ago, CHP pulled me over, and guy was perfectly nice, you know, chatting with me and, you know, driver's license. And I looked at him and I said, you know, my driver's license is in my bag, which is down on the floor, you know, near my foot. And he looked at me and he said, you know, hand on his holster. And he said, I am so glad you told me that, because if you had reached for it, this would have been a really, really bad situation, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of thing that had I just reached for it, it would have been a problem. But probably the worst thing that happened to me was being arrested when I was walking home. And years ago in Berkeley. I was walking from my car back to my apartment, and it was near Fraternity Row. And police pulled me over and said that they had there'd been a robbery, a bicycle or something was stolen. I was in my young 20s. I was newly minted lawyer. And I ignored all the things that my father had taught me. And when they stopped me, I said, listen, you got to tell me why you're stopping me. And they said, nope, shut up. You know, we'll take care of things here. And I said, look, I know my rights. And one guy put handcuffs on me and said, you'll shut up and you'll do what we tell you. And at this point, I get a little mouthy and I'm like, you know, you guys are in big trouble because I'm a lawyer. I know my rights and you guys are harassing me. You've arrested me for no apparent reason. And then another car pulls up. At this point, they're like four or five cop cars. They shine a big light on me, and I asked them what they're doing, and they said, "Oh, the victim's in the car, and it looks like you're not the guy who stole the bike." And I said, "And you just had a police lineup, an illegal lineup on me. You're in huge trouble now." And at that point, they grabbed me and threw me in the car and arrested me. Now I was out in a couple of hours. But I was upset, you know, ticked off. My law firm certainly quickly weighed in. But, you know, I mean, not a lot of people had the ability to have their lawyers respond right away to that and elicit immediate apologies. And, you know, I was told those guys were disciplined and we left it at that. But, you know, it's just this consistent message that you don't belong. If you are black and you're in an area that they don't believe you belong in, you're mistreated. Mm-hmm. And you probably remember the videotape of Masai Ujiri.
That's the first thing I thought of.
The message that the takeaway for a lot of people is that the immediate assumption was you don't belong on the court here. No matter that you've got a $3,000 suit on and you've got a credential, you're a tall black man, and I don't respect the fact that you have some business reason to be here. Just get out of here. And that's the consistent message that, you know, I feel like I've gotten in my life is you don't belong here in this neighborhood. You don't belong here, wherever it is. And that's the thing that, we constantly deal with.
And I go back to, you know, you mentioning your law firm, like you had the means. Masai in his statement said, I had the means. But what are any other young black men and women going through without the representation to take care of things? And, you know, they're forgotten and the system moves on. And they would be staying in jail much longer for no reason, for just just being black.
The good news
location.
Yeah, the good news is though that those stories that you know we all have that maybe weren't really believed or taken seriously in the past are being heard now. And more of my friends, more of my white friends, you know, are way more empathetic to what is going on. And that's the thing that gives me hope is that, you know, more people care, more people see what's going on and are interested in actually changing it.
Great, great point there. Before we let you go, another topic that hits home for you, and you're bout with cancer and multiple times, multiple myeloma. How's your health right now? And moving forward, what do you have to deal with on a daily basis now to kind of hold your breath? Because that is one fight that you never really put your guard down, no matter what news you get.
Right, right. I think that's right. So I have multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer. I was diagnosed in 2016, right before the start of the college football season that year. And it was discovered through an annual physical. And one of the things that I really, really encourage people to do is to make sure you have an annual physical. I have a number of friends who, particularly males, who have decided for years, I don't need to see a doctor and whatnot. Had I not been having annual physicals, I would not have had a chance to fight this battle. Because I had the annual physical, my longtime doctor noticed a change in my blood work and was able to figure it all out, and I began treatment right away. And for multiple myeloma, there's not currently a cure. There's some tremendous treatments and there's great progress being made, and we're all hopeful that sometime in the near future there will be a cure, but right now there isn't. So we work with the treatments that we have. Right now, my health is good. And I think one of the things that, you know, you hear cancer patients say from time to time is that, you know, cancer changes them. And it certainly has changed me. I'm much more focused on the here and now and the present. And I try not to really look too far down the line. And I try to make sure that when I'm with my kids, when I'm with my wife, when I'm doing college football, that I am there, I'm all in, and not worrying about where things go. Because, you know, each month you get, or I get anyway, a test result about what my numbers are and whatnot. And I can't live my life, you know, in fear or worrying about what the numbers are going to be at the end of the month. So that's generally my approach. I feel good. I've been able to do my normal routine of work, whether that's, you know, with college football or as a lawyer. I don't have the same kind of energy as I had before I got multiple myeloma, but I'm able to do what I need to do. My treatments have varied over the years. It certainly involves chemo, which can have an impact on you. You know, it certainly makes some days a little bit tougher than others. But by and large, I keep a normal routine. I keep all of my workouts. I do all my prep. I do all the things that I need to do. This pandemic has been an additional issue because I have to be very, very careful about where I go and being around people because my immune system is more compromised now. So I'm in the high risk category. So I'm really careful about who I'm around and how I, you know, wash my hands and all that kind of good stuff. But I do appreciate your asking. And if there's one thing I would reiterate to people is just really make sure that you're getting an annual physical, because I kid you not, had I not done that, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you today. I would have lost any opportunity to wage this battle.
Wow. Rod, I'm glad you got that physical, and I'm glad that the fight continues 4 years later, and that right now you feel good, and let's hope, obviously, wherever you're at and the environments you're at, people are practicing social distancing as well as wearing a mask and cleaning their hands. And Rod, can't say enough. Thank you for joining us here on the College Football Podcast. I'm looking forward to catching up with you down the road and listening to you call some games.
Well, it's so great to be with you, and I can't tell you how much of a joy it is to have you part of the college football team. It's just it's so fun to catch you in the studio. It's awesome. I look forward to it every weekend, pal.
Thanks, buddy. Stay safe. Special thanks to Rod Gilmore, Nicole Auerbach, as well as Andy Staples for joining us here on the podcast. And Taylor Schwenk on the other side, always doing a fantastic job holding this together. Well, we're back Monday, and we're going to be talking football, reaction to football games we watched, and the buildup potentially to a Monday night game. Can't wait. And I hope you guys get the chance to watch football tonight as well as over the weekend, and we can at least be cautiously optimistic that we will have more football coming our way after this weekend. Until then, if you want football, wear a mask, stay safe, social distance. Enjoy.